working in the USA.
I'm a public health nurse for low-income first-time moms. I go to places that a lot of my friends and family will never go, ever.
Taking on the work others don't want to do. And a town that's gone from black gold to iron bars. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. Labor Day is over, but let's keep the focus on the lives of working women and men. This week, the hidden side of work. First, we head out to sea, where economic pressures are leading to revolutionary ideas. Julie Eaton is the captain of the Cat Sass. She spends 6 months of the year on the water, and she'll tell you she has the best job in the world. But despite record hauls last summer, she and other boat owners are struggling to make ends meet. The lobster glut forced the price to below $2 a pound. And for the first time in their history, lobstermen are now looking to get organized and form a union. Catherine Luley reports.
Julie Eaton is a lobsterman with a sense of humor. The name of her boat? The Cat Sass. She enjoys being her own boss, and she loves the lifestyle.
All winter, I wait every day to get back on my boat. You know, I have friends that live out of state, and they think it's such a big deal to have an office that has a window in this huge building. Well, you know, I have 5 windows in my boat, and the view changes every day.
Today, Julie heads out of the dock towards Deer Isle Bay, where she fishes for 6 months of the year. But being independent has drawbacks.
It costs me $200 a day just to turn the key on my boat as far as just fuel and bait go.
You don't get rich fishing for lobster, but it's always been a reliable way to make a living. On a good year, Julie makes around $350 a pound or $40,000 a year after she pays for fuel, bait, and maintenance. Until last year, Julie found herself hauling in 700 pounds a day. But here's the catch. So was every other lobsterman. And with the unforgiving laws of supply and demand, the price of lobster plummeted.
Last summer was an extreme summer for us. The price dropped to below $1.50 a pound. I've fished for 27 years and I've never seen the price that low. So trying to pay, you know, everything and make ends meet at $1.50 or less a pound was extremely difficult.
So the lobstermen spread the word for a tie-up, which means they stopped fishing. It was the only way they could see to decrease the supply of lobster. Julie participated, but it didn't raise the price of lobster.
The tie-up could have been more effective if more people tied up. It's very hard to get 5,700 independent businessmen to agree on anything, let alone taking a week or two or three off from fishing in the heartier season.
That's when she realized something would have to change.
Can I have your attention? As you guys know, my name is Julie Eaton, and thank you all so very much for coming, but I'd like to introduce you to...
For the first time in their history, Maine lobstermen want to join a union. This is not a typical union drive. This will be a union of independent contractors, so the union member is also his or her own boss. Joel Pitcher is with the International Association of Machinists. He's holding meetings like this one across the state.
Well, the campaign is to reach out to lobstermen up and down the coast from the Canadian border to the New Hampshire border. Once the numbers are there, we see ourselves more than likely forming a cooperative.
The union has its work cut out for it. For one thing, there is a law that prohibits lobstermen from coming together to discuss the price of their catch. It was passed in 1957 in response to a tie-up by the lobstermen of Vinyl Haven.
They were going to do their best to impact the value of their catch and organized a quasi-strike, a tie-up.
The government drafted a consent decree under the Sherman Antitrust Act. It stopped the tie-up.
The result of that was any individual lobstermen going forward do not have the ability to talk about the price of their catch. That incident and that consent decree is alive and well today in everybody's minds, 3 generations later.
But the consent decree does have a loophole. Independent lobstermen can come together as a cooperative business. Joel says once the union membership reaches a majority of lobstermen, it can help to organize a statewide cooperative.
If they act cooperatively and form a cooperation, they can talk about the value of their catch. That's the end game.
Julie's enthusiastic about the union, but she's well aware it won't be easy. Here's how she sells the idea to her fellow lobstermen.
I don't feel at all threatened by the fact that by joining and helping to form a union, that I'm losing any of the control in my business. I'm not giving up any of my independence. I'm simply gaining a voice.
As the season begins, the price of the catch is on everyone's mind.
I think that ultimately, by uniting as fishermen, ultimately this union will lead us into a co-op situation where we can collectively sell our product at a higher price, collectively bargain with the dealers to get a better price, to get the price that we deserve, a fair living wage.
For Salt Radio, I'm Catherine Lulley in Deer Isle, Maine.
An equally independent-minded group of workers are American farmers. They were the original small business people, raising food for themselves and selling or bartering the surplus. Factory farms have gobbled up many family farms, but there are also starry-eyed newcomers who dream of their own organic, self-sufficient farm. Producers Madeline Warren and Ellen Wong of WIOX set up a van in upstate New York and invited farmers to come in and tell their stories.
Last week, I set up my first farmer confession booth in the back of Madeline's delivery truck. I invited farmers to come in, sit down, and record their answers to 5 questions.
Ready?
Okay.
All right, I'm going to lead you to it. Enjoy.
Okay.
Have fun.
Oh, do you want me to just ramble on?
Just ramble.
Oh, tell you about my farm.
Tell
me
about the farm.
Oh, well, I have a blueberry farm. And we.
Question number 1. Tell me about your farm.
We started this 15 years ago, and it evolved into a good thing.
We have a dairy farm. We milk about 75 mixed breed cattle.
We bought our farm 5 or 6 years ago. It was built in 1887 and was farmed for many years. It had been used as a hunting camp for about 30 years, but we're trying to bring it back to production.
We have U-Pick, and it's evolved into a winery. We make blueberry wine too.
If you didn't grow up in farming, the learning curve is pretty steep. You might dream about a farm and wish to have a farm and wish to grow a farm, but it's a lot more labor intensive sometimes than you really realize.
Question number 2.
What do you covet on your neighbor's farm and why?
Our barn is falling down, so if I coveted something on my neighbor's farm, it would be a barn that was fixed or the ability to fix the barn.
The end of the road setting that's away from the road and traffic, that's pretty neat. She's also got a really nice new tractor.
I'm reading on here and I'm trying to.
Question number 3.
One of the things that they asked is what part of my farm wouldn't I'd like you to know about? Well, you can know about it all. I have nothing that is bad on my farm. I have no little dirty piles of waste anywhere or anything like that.
There's probably some areas of pasture that are really overgrown and lots of weeds and lots of thistles, and that doesn't reflect good grazing management.
I don't mind showing people any of my farm, although I get ashamed sometimes of the amount of weeds because I'm the only person that is working there, and maybe that would be another thing that I could use is more help.
Question number 4.
Do we fantasize about giving up farming? Yes.
Oh yeah, there are times when you think about not having the responsibility of so many animals or paying bills or things like that.
I do fantasize about giving it up. Not that it's not a bad thing. But I'm getting old, and I'd love to turn my farm over to some young person.
Since I'm new to farming, I don't really think about giving it up yet, although there are days when I wonder why I stopped being a teacher. My family thinks I'm a little bit nuts.
Just to be free from all that for a time would be awesome. whether it be to hang out far, far away, yep, rest, sleep in. It would get old, but it would be nice for a time.
And finally, question number 5.
And why are you the best farmer?
Why am I the best farmer? Why are we the best farmers? Yeah, no, we're not.
Well, I think I'm the best blueberry farmer anyway.
We're pretty laid back about a lot of things. I think that helps us get through. Although, then you don't get things done that you want to get done, so.
I know many farmers that are better than I am, but I'm working really hard to become the best farmer I can be and produce quality vegetables for my family and my neighbors and my community. And I have the best eggs in town.
Are you a farmer? Do you have something to confess? Or something you'd just like to share? Email me, Cassie, at cassie.wagler@gmail.com.
Up next, a job where fear is part of the daily routine, and a California town that traded an oil boom for prison cells. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1260. Avenel, California is a town that was born with an oil boom, but the boom went bust, as booms often do. Avenel struggled to find a new economy and identity. They embraced an industry most other communities didn't want, but it has not turned out the way the town expected.
In 1929, oil was discovered in the Kettleman Hills, and the nearby town of Avenel was born.
Well, here it is, honey. This will be where we're going to live for, well, for a while anyway.
It's beautiful here, darling. I love it.
In the movie Boomtown, Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert moved to the area seeking their fortune in oil production.
Yeah, they call it Kettleman Hills.
Kettleman Hills doesn't even sound like oil.
But by the 1960s, the oil business dried up. Today, the town's population is officially a little more than 14,000. But that number's a little deceiving. More than a third of that population is behind bars. Avenel State Prison is structured like a town within a town. There's a furniture factory, a metal fabrication shop, and this egg production complex, which supplies 100,000 eggs a day to correctional facilities across the state. Inmates like Alfonso Martinez can earn between 20 and 95 cents an hour here.
The benefit is you get away all day, it's away from the madness in the buildings. I think that's my good benefit for me.
Outside the prison gates, about a quarter of Avenel's population is out of work. The town never really recovered from the oil company's departure, and seasonal farm work jobs here are no match for oil boom wages. So, in the 1980s, when city leaders heard that the state was looking to build more prisons, Avenel became the first California town to solicit a prison. State officials were surprised, says longtime Mayor Harlan Cassada.
Usually they would be met at the city limits with a vigilante crew saying, we don't want a prison. But I think we looked at it differently.
The town saw an opportunity, high-paying permanent jobs for locals and a surge of new residents moving to town and improving Avenel's tax base. It never really happened.
Another empty garage.
Community activist Ray León drives through a housing development called the Westview, built in anticipation of correctional officers moving to Avenel. It's run down now with a lot of vacancies. León grew up in Avenel, and as a child, he watched crews building the prison from his family room window.
Essentially, what happened is that I became an EDD, economic development dud.
Some local kids have gotten jobs in the prison industry after college, but fewer than 10% of the prison's employees live in Avenel. Many commute for more than an hour to get here.
It was a very big disappointment.
That's Donna Curdy, a passionate teacher of GED classes at the prison.
We felt that we had a lot to offer. We had good schools at that time, but they never gave us really a chance, you know, to even know us. So it was kind of a hurt all the way around, I think, because it just didn't generate like we thought it would.
Curdy's roots run deep in Avenel. Both of her grandfathers worked the Discovery Well in the oil fields, and she taught public school for decades. One of the prison's earliest boosters, Curdy now says she'd advise a little caution to other towns.
Well, they'd have to sit down and think about it real, real hard. What did you want from that prison? We were kind of interdependent, really. It's like a mother and a child, I guess.
The town gets about $100 per capita from the state for things like streets and city operations. And when the prison came in, the state paid for capital costs, like the new water and sewage treatment plants the prison and town share. Mayor Harlan Cassada.
If we had it to do over, I would say, yeah, I'd do it over. It's been that much benefit versus the negative.
If there's a fire in Avenel, the prison fire department and its inmate crew are first responders. An inmate in the metal shop even made the decorative light sconces for the renovated downtown theater. With big prison contracts like food services and construction, the state usually hires companies far from Avenel. But locals say prison staff and visitors help the bottom line of local small businesses.
This is carnitas.
Leo Martinez helps his parents run La Nueva Reina, a taqueria and meat market known for its handmade chorizo sausage.
A lot of family members that come and visit our relatives over there in prison, well, they come over here just to eat. We have a lot of correctional officers, too.
Avenel invested in a facelift when the prison came in.
When the prison came, they started building curbs and gutters around here.
A group of guys in their 40s are gathered around a truck, getting ready for a family gathering.
It's pretty ugly back in the day without the prison here.
It improved a little bit, but, you know, not much.
But Debbie Reyes of the California Prison Moratorium Project says those little improvements don't outweigh the real costs of prisons. She sees the social impact on children who grow up in a prison shadow.
If I were that child playing football in the field and I'm living with a gun tower in my overlooking my school, I think that desensitizes that child from their environment, right? That's a norm.
This is personal work for Reyes. Her brother's locked up in Avenel, and she's a Valley native. This town started a prison boom in the Central Valley, which now houses nearly 20 adult and youth facilities, more than in any other region of the state.
There's Atwater, there's Delano, Owasco, Avenel, Mendota, Mule Creek, Folsom.
Even though some small towns have rejected prison development, the Central Valley's been dubbed Prison Alley.
The communities that are targeted here are Spanish-speaking only, low education, farm working communities.
Communities, she says, which haven't gotten out of poverty with the growing number of prisons. Next to the small highway on the edge of town, only a few cars go by. Organic carrot fields and ranch land run up to the edge of the hills, and Chuy Resendez and his buddies are still hanging around the truck telling stories about growing up in Avenel.
Me and him, we love it. We love this, you know. No traffic, no people. We're like a bunch of hillbillies. We love this stuff.
For them and the others who choose to live here, regardless of its uncertain future, Avenel is still the perfect home.
Deal with the traffic, you know, one car in front of you is, I guess, traffic for them.
Well, you got that story comes to us courtesy of AfterTheGoldRushRadio.com. And finally, public health nurse Amy Gastelum shares her thoughts on fear and its cost, working in a Brooklyn neighborhood where safety can't ever be taken for granted.
Have a good day.
Every day I leave my apartment in a part of Queens where nobody worries about me getting hurt.
Hi, good morning.
A lot of people who take the G train south to Brooklyn get off at stops that connect to Manhattan. There aren't a lot of people who get off the train at my stop. There are no connections to the city here. It's Bed-Stuy, the heart of Brooklyn. This is where some people worry about me. I make visits to people's homes in this neighborhood. I'm a public health nurse for low-income first-time moms. I go to places that a lot of my friends and family will never go, ever. For some of them, that means certain blocks of Bed-Stuy. For others, it means stepping into a tiny stainless steel elevator wet with urine in a public housing complex. I just can't see my father-in-law there, and he can't either. So when we talk about my job, he fixates on safety. Pat has encouraged me to carry a taser, and my mother-in-law wants me to carry bear spray, which is mace. Enough for a bear.
Morning.
A few people want me in self-defense classes. I'm told to keep my face up and look around. Don't look down and distracted. Don't stand next to vans. Someone could open the door and snatch me. Don't wear overalls because someone could cut the straps with a knife. Don't wear my hair in a ponytail. Someone could grab it and control me that way. But my favorite advice is this. If I need to get on an elevator and there's a creepy person there too, fake a conversation on my flip phone. Oh, hi, yeah, this is Amy. Okay, then hold up a finger and tell the creepy person, oh, go on up. It's my boss on the phone. Like they care who it is. A lot of the other nurses do this. But I think if I tried it, I would laugh at myself and they would think I was creepy making fake phone calls and laughing. To be fair, all the advice I'm given is not completely baseless. There have been attacks on visiting nurses. In 2010, Carrie Lynn Johnson was caring for a patient in Detroit and someone entered the house, shot her and her patient, and set the house on fire. Then there was the home visiting nurse in New Orleans who was kidnapped and raped by 5 men last year while working. One nurse at my job was walking on the street and got punched in the face for her iPhone. She always finishes the story saying she shouldn't have brought it out. She has to say that, or someone else will. I know that if I embrace fear and I'm attacked, people will say it wasn't her fault. She was very cautious. But if I don't show the right amount of fear and I'm attacked, people will say I was careless and I will have to take some of the blame. It's not that I'm fearless. I'm not from this city and I'm pretty small. I have my own fear I carry, but the consensus seems to be that it's not enough. I jokingly told a friend that my plan for the guys who started to follow me one day was to tell them I'm an undercover cop. I laughed at myself. She didn't smile. She said, Amy, you may think you have a plan, but those guys stood there all day thinking of a plan for you.
Made it.
I feel powerless and exhausted when people remind me to be afraid. You know, walking into a patient's life saying, I'm going to take care of you without being 100% sure if you're safe is something that nurses have always done. But usually the risk is infection. The nurses that took care of HIV-positive patients in the 1980s must have been afraid. And maybe their friends and family couldn't understand why they would want to keep doing that work. But their friends and families never got to see their human patients being human beings.
Hello.
I can't stop someone from hurting me if they really want to. But fear makes me give up on friendliness with the people who also walk in the neighborhood. Fear messes up my ability to see my client as a unique individual if I'm scared of her environment or her family. I give up on ponytails and overalls. I give up on daydreams like gifts that wander in while I walk between visits. Fear requires my whole brain. I would rather take the blame.
Amy Gastelum is a public health nurse in Brooklyn. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.